Good evening. This is Jack Moyles inviting you to hear The Real Story.
The man who learned that kindness brings its own reward. The forgotten inventor who discovered his greatest success in failure. The perfect butler and the king. Tonight, Jack Moyles explains how they tell the real story.
Bill Riley is a doorman out in New York. And as such, he's never paid much attention to the people pushing and milling about him. His job is for seats, making sure that everyone holds his place and moves up in turn. And then one night, not so long ago, as Bill stood looking out, spoke to him, a soft, low, feminine voice, which asked, "Please, sir, I'm not as strong as I used to be. This pushing and shoving is just a bit more than I can stand. Would it be wrong to let an old lady?" Murray refusal on the tip of his head wouldn't come out. He found an old woman, white hair. He could never explain to himself just why he did it, but then and there, doorman Bill Riley broke a most important rule. He held up the rope and motioned for the little old lady to step under. Then he marched her inside until she stood at the head of the line. He walked stiffly back to his post and glared at the crowd. But nobody cared. In fact, most of them thought it was pretty nice of Bill. And so a custom was born. Whenever this little old lady came to the show after that, she'd work her way through the crowd until she reached the rope near Bill. He'd smile, lift up the rope for her to step under, and then he'd proudly march her up in front of all the others. Finally, Bill noticed she didn't come around anymore. He often wondered about her, where she was and what had happened to her. Then one day, a lawyer called on him in his dressing room and told him first that Mrs. Edna Elliott and that she'd stopped coming to the Roxy because of illness. Illness which finally took her life. But before she died, she changed her will. Changed it in order to leave doorman Bill Riley nearly $150,000. Just because he always took her up to the head of the line.
Inventor who found his greatest success in failure.
There's little in common between modern total war and the manner and style in which military campaigns have been fought in the past. And the principal reason, of course, is the increasing use of new and terrifying weapons. We were thinking about this recently when it was brought to our attention that what used to be considered the most destructive of all the tools in the arsenal of war is now something almost taken for granted. We're talking about that commonplace weapon, the torpedo, better known merely as tin fish, capable of sinking the largest battleship afloat. Yet no longer dramatized on page one in the same large type now employed to describe such things as the atomic bomb. Yet behind the creation of the first torpedo is the strange story of a forgotten inventor who found his greatest success in defeat. He was a mouse-like little fellow, happiest when he was tinkering away in the dingy workshop behind his New York home. But there was also something of the practical man in his makeup. When the idea of the torpedo came to him, he slowly took out his pipe and sat down for a moment in order to figure things out. He reasoned that possibly his torpedo would be so new and deadly that the threat of using it might act to prevent war if placed in the proper hands. And for such placement, he deduced, there should be a good and substantial fee. He smiled happily when he thought of that part of it. Maybe he'd be paid enough to keep him in comfort for the rest of his life. But first, of course, he'd have to prove that the plan in his mind would really work. So quickly, he knocked the ashes from his pipe and plunged into the task of building the first real-life torpedo. When completed, it was simplicity itself, a long wooden tube filled with gunpowder, designed to explode on contact when it reached the target, and propelled through the water by a clockwork mechanism. Because this was 1797, and George Washington was still President of the United States. The little inventor hauled his torpedo to a lonely spot on the Hudson River for testing. There he launched it and aimed it across the stream at a spot where a huge oak tree stood growing at the water's edge. When released, the torpedo ran its course straight as an arrow. There was a tremendous explosion, and water, mud, smoke, and the ripped branches of the oak tree filled the sky. Watching, the inventor was spellbound for a moment. Then he clapped his hands like a child with a new toy and started back for the city. He had just one idea in mind, to take his plans to the new government of the United States. And because this was his own country, he wouldn't make the price too high. Possibly he'd even settle for a modest pension. Anything at all, just so he wouldn't have to go on mending clocks for a living while he tinkered with inventions which somehow never bore fruit. But eventually, when he faced the admiral in charge of passing on such matters, it didn't take his gruff old sea dog long to send the little clockmaker on his way broken-hearted. "I'm sorry, my good fellow, but I can't see any merit in your plan. But if you ever happen to have any other ideas, hope you'll make it a point to come back and see me." But the little inventor didn't come back that day or ever. Instead, he borrowed enough money to buy a ticket to Europe. And the time came when he timidly left his torpedo blueprint with the officers of someone passed judgment upon it. The very next morning, he was routed from bed by the British Sea Lord himself, a blustering Englishman who excitedly explained,
"Oh, my dear fellow, I've come to borrow your invention immediately. You see, England has been deadlocked in her war with France for years, and all because our fleet and the French fleet are so evenly matched. But I think possibly your torpedo might turn the tables and give us victory."
And with that, the First Sea Lord held out a contract for the amazed little inventor to sign. A peculiar contract, which affirmed simply that England would demand exclusive rights to use the new weapon, and that the British would pay the American for torpedoes actually used in battle £20 apiece. With his head in the clouds, the little inventor grabbed a nearby quill and signed. And because it was guaranteed that his pay was to be determined by the number of torpedoes actually used in conflict, when it came around to the time for the British Navy to spring its new weapon on the French, the little inventor went along with the fleet as an official observer, perched on a stool on the bridge of the flagship itself. Well, the two fleets met in the English Channel under a clear sky and sailing a calm sea, lining up for action as they lined up dozens of times before, with marines in the rigging armed with muskets and 16-pounders lining the deck. But on the British ships, there was more than the usual pre-battle tenseness, because every Jack Tar was waiting to see what would happen when the new torpedoes were launched. The French fleet came up with the wind, anxious to grapple at close quarters. But as the first French ship drew abreast of the leading English craft, British seamen aboard this craft carefully launched the first tin fish. There was a moment of silence, with that telltale streak of white water marking the path straight to the target. A blinding explosion followed, and in the next breath, where once there had been a proud French man of war, there was nothing but floating wreckage. A cheer went up from the British then. For their part, the French changed course in a hurry, swinging out of range. Finally, a gig was lowered from the deck of the largest French warship, a gig with a huge white truce banner floating from the stern. A dozen sailors bent over the oars, while a short, stocky Frenchman, whose uniform was covered with ribbons and medals, sat stiffly beneath the white flag and directed the rowers toward the English flagship. And the sight of this particular Frenchman brought another great cry from the British Tars. For here was a man these sailors recognized, Admiral Dupré, commander-in-chief of the French. Apparently stunned and stupefied by England's new weapon was this Admiral Dupré, and on his way to surrender his fleet. And that's what the British Admiral thought, too, as a rope ladder was thrown down and the French commander slowly climbed up and stepped out on deck. But the first words of the Frenchman were something else again.
"I have not come to surrender. I have come under a temporary truce to protest. War, Marshal, it is my request that we continue to fight as we always have fought, or we French will be forced to conclude that the officers of the British Navy are no longer gentlemen."
Au revoir. With these words, the French admiral bowed and returned to his gig. Embarrassed and confused, the English admiral hurried to his stateroom, where he called an immediate conference of his general officers. And when that conference finally broke up, it was agreed that perhaps these new torpedoes were unchivalrous. And so, later that day, when the two fleets sailed once again into action, they went back to the fight in the same old style of years before. No one was hurt very much, and not a single vessel was sunk. At sundown, the French sailed for port, and the British returned to England. The next day, in the offices of the British Admiralty in London, this scene. Seated at his desk, the First Lord of the Admiralty, facing him the heartbroken little inventor from America. Carefully, the first Sea Lord counts out 20 pounds, payment for the one torpedo used in battle. Next, he takes out the contract they've signed, and slowly he tears it to bits, explaining the decision of the fleet against torpedoes has made the contract worthless. Then, as a gesture of friendship, the first Sea Lord hands the inventor a ticket back to New York. And there you have the story of the man who invented the torpedo before the world was ready to use it. The little inventor with the rosy dreams, who hoped that his torpedo would bring him luxury and ease. But instead, he went back to his workbench in America, back home to start out all over again. Although it must be reported that eventually he did come up with an idea, which has been rather successful. The idea for the steamship. Well, you see, the little man who created the torpedo ahead of its time was Robert Fulton.
Page 3, the story of the perfect butler.
Frederick Burgess of England can rightfully claim to be the world's perfect butler. For 30 years, he's been master butler in charge of the most important royal functions in Britain. His aloof dignity and smooth efficiency can put to shame even the infallible Jeeves of fiction and such professional gentlemen-in-waiting as Eric Bloor and Arthur Treacher of the films. And now word comes that Mr. Burgess is going to retire in a few weeks on a national pension. The publication of this news was the signal for London reporters to rush out and interview him on the question, what are the qualifications of a perfect butler? After some thought, Mr. Burgess replied,
the perfect butler must be prepared at all times, no matter what the occasion, for the most unusual emergencies.
Later, friends went on to give an example right from the modest hero's own life. They recalled the time when he was serving at a royal knighthood ceremony. King George V was bestowing the exalted honors. But just as the king bent to help one of the knights to his feet, the royal suspenders suddenly snapped. There was a horrified silence. The king looked around in agony. But cool as the proverbial cucumber, Master Butler Frederick Burgess motioned the king to step behind a nearby screen. Burgess followed, serene, unruffled, complacently pulling from his pocket a brand new pair of suspenders and wearing an expression on his face that said, plainer than words,
the true gentleman's gentleman is prepared for anything.
Tune in again next week over most of these ABC stations and hear Jack Moyles tell you the real story.
This is Jack Moyles inviting you to join us again next week. In the meantime, remember, there are stranger things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy.
This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.